Well, hello, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and all that kind of stuff. It is Thursday, the 16th of November. Welcome to the show. And welcome back in the wintry months. Actually, they're not yet, are they? It's still autumn, but it's doing a good impersonation of winter down here where I am. In tonight's show, we've got a couple of pals. Yeah, P-A-L. We've got a couple of pals here on Pell, on Paul English Live. You can see I've been working on that one all week, right? Snappy, or what? And there's going to be a small little intro bit. I want to talk about rats, I think, if I can find these rats. I'm going to have a chat with these rats. And we'll also, we might talk about Napoleon a bit too. Not too much. And then coming up in about 20 minutes, 25 minutes time, something like that, we're going to be joined by Paul Patriot and Donald Kent from Patriotic Art Live, P-A-L. Those are the pals I was telling you about. Ah, yeah, gotta fade this down now. Hi, welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. We're on, what show number are we on? We're nearly 3 months into this thing, so it's show number 11 already, which is quite a thing. It is the My How Time Flies when your civilization is being destroyed from within. And it's good to have you back again. As I said, we've got a couple of very interesting chaps coming up a little bit later. Well, not too later, as I said, about 15, 20 minutes time. And I was just scouting around for a few things. I wanted to just wrap up a few loose ends or mention a few things that I'd not covered recently. Obviously, a couple of weeks ago, we had David Fleming. Last week, we're covering a lot of other things. And not too much talk. I got an email about this. Not too much talk recently about the French Revolution. Nobody else has said anything, so maybe it's much to the relief of everybody. Although, I'd noticed in several groups quite a few people kicking off about the French Revolution. And I was drawn into a conversation sneakily yesterday by someone, which was one of those things. One of those little conversations about, Paul, where's the French Revolution stuff? You know, so I thought, oh, this is good. We've struck a nerve here. But the point I was making yesterday, and I would just like to mention again, I've not lost the thread with that. I'm about halfway through the Nesta Webster book, The French Revolution, interestingly titled. And as I've said before, I'd recommend it to anybody who wants to stick their nose into that stuff. I don't know whether I'd mentioned Madame Roland, who I've just come across, unfortunately, in the narrative. It sounds like a soap opera, but she really is. She came to a very bad end. Just to let you know, all the plotters in and around the French Revolution, all the Girondins, most of the leaders of that, the Duke d'Orléans, Robespierre himself, they too ended up visiting Madame la Guillotine. And so it's quite a horrific event. It turns out that this woman, Madame Roland, or Roland, I suppose, if I try to speak French properly, which of course is a big worry for all of us, but she was instrumental in really, she's like the fuse that lights the whole thing. And Although it might not have been obvious from me covering it over the past few weeks, just to let you know, this thing was long in the making and long in the organising and was sputtering at all turns and times. In other words, what happened was they would get something going. I think they got something going in 1989. Then it goes quiet for nearly 2 years, but they don't stop plotting. And it becomes obvious from reading in between the lines, or even reading the lines. In fact, it becomes obvious from actually reading the words in the book that there is a great deal of organization, energy, and money behind getting this thing off the ground. It's not a spontaneous event. And if you've got a very rough view of the French Revolution, and I suspect most people do, this is the reason why I wanted to go and have a look at it, because I was reasonably familiar with the English so-called Civil War. Yet again, a great deal of organizing goes into that, unbeknownst to most people. It's not a spontaneous uprising at all. And I knew a great deal of most of the conflicts that happened after the French Revolution, but that one right in the middle there, I didn't know too much about. And I may have mentioned it before, but it's worth repeating. You really do get a horrific impression of the malleability of crowds, the volatility of them, and the sheer lethality of crowds when they are roused up. And Madame Roland was key in that. She had a salon, not that I've had a salon, but, you know, a talking shop. And that's where much of the intrigue and the pushing and the emotional blackmailing and the bullying and the embarrassing of certain leaders came about to get them to push and do these sorts of things. I don't know if I'd mentioned, by the way, that when they actually stormed Versailles the first time, this is about 1798, and nearly killed the king and Marie Antoinette, many of the people that attacked it were men dressed up as ladies. How about that? No, it wasn't the first sort of movements of the transgender movement at all. They were basically imitating leading ladies of Paris because they were deemed to be trustworthy. They had a sort of honorable reputation, but they weren't the leading ladies of Paris. They were hairy-legged, violent men that had been brought in from all over the place, who obviously were quite willing to dress up as women, which, of course, is a little bit odd. But this enabled them to sort of get in and undercover and do all these sorts of other things. And in fact, the honourable women of France, the actual real honourable women of France, protested. They said, these are not really real women, which is really rather good of them to say that, isn't it? But of course, they were kind of ignored. And as were many other groups, there were warning signals going off all the time. And I want to emphasise here, I mean, I'm about halfway through the thing, right? It's about 500 pages. I'm just about halfway through. I've not looked at it for a couple of days. But I think the key point is that they loved the king. This may be a surprise to you. They loved him. He loved them. He did everything he possibly could, and yet the fix was in. They were going to do whatever they could to get rid of him, and they did anything and everything to do just that. So there's a lethality about the whole thing that really comes across. And the point I wanted to make as well was this. We live, of course, in troubled times. I'm looking at this to see what happens. You know, you might have thought, oh, it's the people naturally uprising and fixing things. Yeah, right. as far as I'm aware, and I was talking about this yesterday as well, some reprobate roped me into a conversation yesterday. It's a terrible series of events. He knows what I'm talking about. He might turn up a little bit later. And was talking about this natural spontaneous uprising of people, something that may have occurred to you. You may have thought about it. And what was occurring to me is that the only event I'm aware of where it's naturally happened, where it happened quite naturally, was the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. Now, there've got to be others, probably around that time and certainly across Europe. But for those of you who want to be refamiliarized a little bit with English history, 1381, long time ago, there were only about 2.5 million people living in England at the time. This is because nearly 50% of the population had been wiped out by disease, the Black Death or whatever it was. There are all sorts of plagues and stuff, but there was a big one in the 1300s. And the peasants that were left on the land were only about half the peasants that they used to be, and yet they were expected to do the same workload. Now, that is a spontaneous uprising by the people. And it's I'll get into that. I've mentioned it before, I think, here. And at some point down the line, maybe before Christmas, before this year's out, we'll look at that one in a bit more detail because it's very important. I mean, I'm obviously interested in it because it's here on home turf. In fact, I'm not a million miles away from where it started. It all kicked off in Kent. So the Kent people have got something to be proud of. Wat Tyler organised all this. And they got 100,000 men to march on London. This is in 1381. Of course, these were rather tough, leathery, hardened men who'd been out in the fields. And they were not to be trifled with. And he shook the whole nation to the core. And just to let you know, they killed him whilst he was literally in negotiations with the king on the back of his horse. The mayor of London, Walworth, who also used to run brothels, just to let you know, these are the sort of characters we're talking about, so things don't really change, was very cross and insulted by the way he was talking to the king and came up and plunged a dagger in his back. So there you go. And they keep that dagger to this day in Fishmongers Hall. I've never seen it, but it's up there. It's called The Red Dagger. And there's a great poem by Heathcote Williams, which I'm going to bring into the show at some point soon because it's fantastic. And they keep that there as a memento, as if plunging daggers into people's backs is a good thing. And I suppose, really, from their point of view, it was. Okay. So there we go. Now, whilst I'm still on the French thing, I've got to mention just in passing, in brief, that a week today, I think it's a week today, is it a week yesterday? So a week today is Thanksgiving. Am I right? I think I'm right. It's the last but one Thursday of the month. I am right. So 23rd of November in the States, they're all going to go crazy for turkeys or whatever they do. I've never sort of gone into the whole thing. As I've said before, my astonishment is that it's turkey at the end of November and then it's turkey at the end of December. So tough luck if you're a turkey, I guess. But it also happens to be this time next week, next Wednesday, the day before, and I suppose it's for Thanksgiving weekend in the States. It'll be why it's been timed this way. The release of Napoleon by Sir Ridley Scott, who will be 86, round about the same day. I think a couple of days after that, he hits 86. And I saw an interview with him recently on YouTube. There's been quite a few things, of course, building up in the promo of the film. And they were going through some of the battle scenes and what he'd done and the sheer scale of the crew, which is enormous. I mean, it's like an army anyway. So, hang on just a minute. I've just got to check something out here. Let me just check something, see if there's a problem. There might be a problem. Is there a problem? I don't know. I'm just going to ask people on Rumble. Sorry about this, but this is the internet. Can you hear me? Apparently not. Let me just have a look. Oh, I see. Good grief, what an idiot. Hang on just a minute. Sorry about that, everyone. Hi. Rumble crowd, sorry about that. We had a glitch there. We've been going out live over WBN324. Got to do a bit of house cleaning. We've been going live out of WBN324.com since we started, and over Speak Free Radio, and over EFR. I believe, but not on Rumble. What an idiot. I'm terribly sorry about that. I can see what happened there. This is, I still need to grow that extra pair of arms and fingers to press all these buttons. So my apologies. If you're in Rumble right now and in the chat, if you could just type up and say that the sound has arrived, because it should have done. So you'll just have to listen to the first 30 minutes, I guess, back on the podcast. They were brilliant, by the way. I'm terribly sorry about that. It was probably the best bits of broadcasting I've ever done. No, not really. But there we go. You should be getting sound through on that. So if you could let me know. Fantastic. Thank you very much, Warren App Arthur 503-579. That's the... I'll just call you Warren from now on. Thanks, Warren, for the notification. So apologies to everybody in Rumble for that. But I've just spotted what caused that. It was a... You don't want to know. You don't want to know. It's too boring. Where was I? Yeah, Napoleon. So the Napoleon film is out this coming Wednesday. And Sir Ridley Scott, a lot of interviews about the battle scenes. There's a very good one on YouTube, about 16 minutes long, talking about it. The sheer scale of the filming is amazing. However, I've got a little caveat to add in, and I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to, because it came to my ears on Friday, just gone. I was over at a friend's house, and I brought this up. You know, I think I ought to get one of those hats and march around with one of those hats. I don't know why I've got so keen about it. I suppose, in great part, A, it's because I wanted to study the French Revolution, which, of course, is the crucible from which Napoleon gets born, effectively. I mean, maybe not literally, but it's going to be always drawn that way. And the French Revolution cleared France of so many individuals, so many authoritarian individuals, and he came to power. So it seemed very appropriate to look at this because of this film coming up. Anyway, I'm over at a friend's the other day eating some marvellous bread. It was honey and oat bread. I know bread can be a bit, you know, but anyway, I enjoyed that bread. Thank you very much, Diane, if you're listening. That was absolutely marvellous. And I just mentioned the film. Anyway, it turns out that Diane's got a son, which is, you know, useful. And he's naughty, apparently. I don't know his name, so I can't give it away. But he's naughty because he apparently has already seen it on one of these illegal streaming services, which, of course, I never do. Seriously, I don't. I don't even know where they are. And unfortunately, what she said was that he had said that, in part, brace yourself, this is a terrible four-letter word that I'm about to use, and we'll have to see whether this is true or not, but he said that the film, in parts, was woke. Did a little shudder of disgust run through your body? I hope it did. Anyway, I hope he's wrong, but already. So I've said I'm probably bigging it up way too much without knowing exactly how it's going to go. We'll have to see. I'm sure they can't make the military battles woke. Who knows? I've no idea what that would look like. And I would be sorely disappointed in Ridley Scott if that is the case. So maybe. Anyway, so there's that little caveat with the thing coming up, you know. So bear in mind, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Paul English Live here at paulenglishlive.com. We go out every Thursday from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. UK time, 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. US Eastern. What's that? 2 p.m. Central start time, 1 p.m. Mountain, midday Pacific start time here every Thursday doing that. We're going out on WBN324.com, WBN324.zil, Z-I-L. And the ZIL domains are easily accessible through the Opera browser if you're using that. And there are other browsers that have got attachments or plugins that you can put into so that you can get through to these domain names, which are on a decentralized network. And of course, we're having to pay more and more attention to these sorts of things because there are all sorts of regulations coming into play where we're going to be probably sending around gagging teams, I would imagine, with little ropes and wrap them, you know, you can't speak at all now on a Thursday or whatever it might be. So, but we've had some little act passed over here, which may turn out to be not so little after all, as the people in charge get a little bit panicky about certain things. In the wings, I've got a couple of pals. There's a couple of pals in the wings. There's Donald Kent and Paul Patriot. I'll be bringing them in a couple of minutes. But first, I just want to mention something about... Let me just find this. I wanted to mention something about rats. I think I mentioned rats, didn't I, at the beginning? Let me just find my little rat piece. Where did I put that? See? People all quiet on Rumble, can't find the rats. Okay. This is an article over on off-guardian.org. Fantastic website if you're not aware of it. off-guardian.org. It's called Dr. Richter's Diabolical Experiment by Todd Hayden. Or is it Hayden? Todd Hayden, sorry. And I just want to read you a little bit of this. This, so you'll get a gif. This is just about behavioral awfulness. Ever heard of Dr. Kurt Richter? He writes, neither had I. During the time in the United States where nearly anything was done in the name of science, Dr. Kurt Richter, a renowned physiologist and behavioral scientist, conducted his seminal experiments on rats. Excited? You won't be. He presented his most famous experiment sometime in the mid-1950s at Johns Hopkins University. Apparently, it was about the effects of despair and hopelessness on the survival rate of rats. The kindly scientist placed his beloved rats into buckets of water and began timing their frantic swimming. You see, the rats believed they were going to drown and did whatever they could to save their pathetic lives. They didn't realize that the good doctor had a gentle soul and would rescue them before their watery demise. But he didn't. Not at first, at least, and many rats met their maker after about 15 minutes of futile paddling. The next round of rats were the lucky ones, although some would say unlucky. These pitiful fellows were observed until the indicated exhaustion time, but then plucked up out of the water in the nick of time to be daintily dried off and set out to rest. Hurrah! Saved! We're all happy for these rats, aren't we? A miracle for sure, and oh, what a relief. After a brief stint of R&R, the rats were then dumped back into the bucket, which ultimately turned out to be their watery grave after all, but not in the aforementioned 15-minute exhaustion time, but rather an impressive and miraculous, brace yourselves, 60 hours. Oh, wonder of wonders, how could it be that these tiny creatures could extend the fleeting energy it took to stay alive for so long? Hope. Hope, you say? Yes, it was hope, he writes. They had been rescued before, so surely they would be rescued again. You're beginning to see parallels in our condition. I hope not, but I am. They had indubitable faith in Dr. Kurt and knew he would, at the last minute, pluck them from sure death. But he didn't. He is a tough man, Dr. Kurt. No, the good doctor wanted to see how long hope would sustain them, how long that glimmer of belief in the goodness of man could glow in the hearts and muscles of the poorest of poor beasts. But that saviour never came, and after about 60 hours, they died. He was a hero in the science world, of course, and what he determined in his little reprehensible experiment is that at least rats were capable of expending energy to stay alive if they were led falsely to believe they would at some point be saved. Psychologists often cite this experiment as evidence of the power of hope. Hope can be the factor that changes an outcome from really bad to really good, at least with rats. I wonder if Dr. Richtery writes wanted, at least secretly, to try out his experiment on humans. Well, he may well have done. In fact, I've got a mouse experiment about that. So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're hoping for things, it might not be so bad. It might, at least it gives us 60 hours of scrabbling time to survive whatever it is we think we're about to succumb to. And I think most of us are pretty aware of what's going on at the moment. I wanted to mention that. That's an incomplete reading, by the way. You'll find the article over, the full article, over off-guardian.org. It just ends, let me read the last couple of paragraphs, which I'd not read earlier. It says, then suddenly we were saved. It all paid off. The corn flowed and we were plucked out of the bucket. Hurrah. COVID ended. So it's about the COVID thing. You can join the dots, I'm sure, here. The summer was pleasant, warm. Oh, no, it was boiling, wasn't it? All was back to normal. So how long will it be, he writes, before we are thrown back in the bucket? Getting the drift? Haven't they got a new COVID variant lined up for public consumption? Start paddling, folks, he says, but don't worry, we'll be saved again. Hurrah. The kind doctors have good hearts. Surely we will be rescued. Believe that, and you'll believe, well, just about anything. Okay, after this little song, which I'm going to play, I'm going to bring in the pals, Donald and Paul. What was the little song I was going to play? Oh, yeah, now this is, I was reminded, you ever seen Jaws? You must have seen Jaws. Remember the character played by Robert Shaw, the gnarly old the gnarly old sea dog that they have to bring in, and because he's the one that they say, we're going to have to get a bigger boat. That was the other character, wasn't it? I remember seeing that. Well, Robert Shaw in it sings a song, Farewell and Adieu, Spanish Ladies, an old English sea shanty. Someone was talking to me about it the other day, and I looked it up. It turns out that Shaw was in another film in the 50s in which he also sang it in the first instance. So he's sung it twice in films. I bet you didn't know that. And maybe that's going to come up on your next pub quiz. I'm not going to play the Shaw version. I'm going to play the unshaw version. Ha ha, that's just a little joke. I'm going to play this version. After this, we'll be here with the pals. Here we go.
Farewell and adieu to you, Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu to you, ladies of Spain. For we've received orders for to sail for old England, but we hope very soon we shall see you again. We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly, it's 35 leagues. We hove our ship to, with the wind at sou'west, boys. We hove our ship to, our soundings to sea. We rounded and sounded, got 45 fathoms. Then we squared our main yard and up channel steered we. We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues.
The next land we made, 'twas called the Dead Man. Next Ramehead off Plymouth, off Portland the White. Then we sailed by Beachy, by Fairley and Dungeness, till we came abreast of the South Fallen Light.
We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues.
Then the signal was made for the Grand Fleet to anchor all in the Downs that night for to lie. Then it's stand by your stoppers, steer clear your shank painters, haul up your clue garnets,
let tacks and sheets fly. We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues.
So let every man toss off a full bumper, and let every man drink off a full glass.
We'll drink and be merry and drown melancholy, singing here's a good health to each true-hearted lass. We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors. We'll rant and we'll roar all on the salt seas until we strike soundings in the channel of old England. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues.
3-4 Radio.
Attention all listeners, are you seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 Talk Radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil. And stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome back to, well, that was just before the bottom of the hour. It's just gone 27 minutes past, coming up to 28 minutes past. And here we are on Paul English Live. Well, here I am anyway, paulenglishlive.com. Got the sound into Rumble. Most of the technical things seem to be okay. So there we go. There's always something, isn't there, each week? What a lot of fun. And I've got with me now, and for the rest of the show, two stout-hearted gentlemen, possibly, or possibly not, I don't know. We have Donald Kent in the USA, and from deepest, darkest Europe, he may reveal where he is, Paul Patriot. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. How are you this kind afternoon, evening, etc., etc.?
Very good. I am stout-hearted and ready to roll.
Are you? Fantastic, Donald. Yes. And Paul, yeah, fantastic. Paul, welcome to the show as well.
Very well. I'm glad to be here. It's been a long time in the making. I think we've been waiting about a month to do this.
Have you?
So, yes. I think so.
Oh, yeah, I think we that's right. We organized it for, about a month back, and I think we had to have a little delay. But it's actually quite a nice problem for someone like me to have, that we've got a sort of, guests lining up, and I've got someone lined up for next week. So it just takes a few months to build up a bit of momentum, and then everybody wants to sort of rock up and turn up and all that kind of stuff. So now, to the listeners, they're not necessarily going to know who you are. They probably, many of them will know who Jody Kidd is, because Jody was on here a few weeks ago. I brought her out of retirement a bit, and we had a cracking little chat about her musical career and everything. And, of course, the connection at the time was to do with the White Ark collective, and because Jody was a part of that, and to do with the, obviously the passing of Jeff and all that. And yet here you are, you two guys, doing PAL, Patriotic Art Live, and maybe you'd like to, well, Donald, introduce yourself, because I don't know too much about you either, so it would be great to get a bit of background, you know.
Yeah, I am a pillar member, a core member of the White Art Collective, and I would say that that's, I guess, the American version of Patriotic Arts Live in the UK, run by Paul Patriart, so that community. And it, we came together, and we'll talk about that more in the show, but there's a huge history with the White Art Collective. The founding father of the organization passed away tragically recently, and I did a few shows to help do fundraisers and to commemorate his great accomplishments, the enormous community that he built, and then just trying to carry the torch on and continue on with creating good white positive content, content for the dissident right, the white identity community out there, and the blogosphere, all of that. So there's really a lot of information to talk about regarding that. I'm a musician, artist, poet. I run my own YouTube channel. You can check that out. I think the link will somehow be available. And I do weekly shows, but well, I'll pass the mic over to Paul. He can take it from here.
Hi, I'm Paul. Go by the name Patriot Online as an alias until I was exposed.
So, were you? You mean to tell me that Patriot is not your real surname, Paul? Well, I never.
Yeah, it was. I guess it, creativity was just a name, you know, just exuding creativity. My mother was prophetic in that way, you know. So, no.
Good old mum.
Yeah. So I run the Patriotic Arts Community, and I kind of got into nationalism some time ago. I would say a good 10 years now, coming up to 15 years. And I've been long-time friends with Mark Collett as well. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I knew him personally before getting involved with sort of helping to support and build communities. So, I started the Patriotic Arts Community initially as a means to to do artwork for different themes. And I just wanted to collaborate with other people to suggest themes and do art. And it kind of just grew from there. And now we do competitions and art contests on various creative themes. And it's been fun. It's been a bit of a ride past 3 years. And here we are now teaming up with Donald Kent, who's helping to carry the torch for Jeff. Mm-hmm. Well, as we said, tragically passed away. But he had a very strong vision and a great insight for how creativity and the arts can really help to kind of retain our culture, but also maintain and keep that torch burning, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Paul, I mean, when you say art and your skill sets, you are... Do you mean graphics, illustration? Is that your particular line? Is that where you specialize, or are you multi-talented?
Well, I trained with more of a traditional background. Obviously, it's going back a while. I'm just turned 30 this year. So,
oh, you're very, very you're ridiculously young. Yeah. That's tremendous.
Happy birthday.
Yeah, well done. Happy birthday for then. Yeah, good grief.
But yeah, obviously, as digital art became quite prominent, I kind of diversified a bit and started focusing more on graphic design and then digital art, really, is my main sort of go-to method of creating now.
Right. Well, I'm going to have to rope you in for more graphics for the show. So there you go. Because today's image is fantastic. I love today's image. I think I was mentioning to you beforehand, each week I just try and find anything that I just like or that I think might just have a bit of impact. It doesn't really matter what it is. And often the show has got nothing to do with the image. I'm just wondering, you're not sat astride a winged horse right now, you two, are you? I mean, there's nothing like that's actually really going on, is it, unfortunately?
Not quite. I might be playing a bit of chess earlier, which I thought was a bit of checkered background was, bit of tactical maneuvering by the three horsemen there.
Yeah. Well, I'm quite busy with, I've got basically three shows that I'm running on my YouTube, all arts related. Well, one of them is called Equal Training. That's more about how to come up with tactics against critical race theory, diversity, equity, inclusion, all that kind of Marxist dialectic that's pushed into our curriculum in America.
The fun stuff. The fun stuff. Yeah. Mean, all the joyful fun stuff that we have to endure. Right. Yeah. Okay.
Right. That, yeah. So that shows more technical and academic in that regard. It's about, you know, explaining these processes. They're it's essentially a curriculum to help teachers, students, and people out in the world and families who want to, you know, defend their kids from Marxism, etc. So that's an exciting program, but I'm just really deeply involved in the arts, and the White Art Collective has many, many people in it that are producing art all the time. So there's another person in the group, another core member, a woman goes by the name Jayla Dark. She runs a program called the Monthly White Art Challenge. Right. And I think there's about 170 different artists in there who each month come up with artwork on a theme. And there's quite a lot of crafters in there. There's some really amazing, beautiful stuff. And they're from all over Europe and the whole, you know, white world, if you will. So it's really a matter of getting, bridging these artists into our communities and getting more attention, more traffic over to our sites and what we're doing, so that, you know, people who are facing the constant demoralization of the politics and all the social engineering that we're undergoing, and get back into revitalizing their spirit and their sense of identity, their connection to their history, their strength of community. And so with all this, that's really the power of the arts. You know, our enemies know the power of the arts. That's why they've infiltrated Hollywood and other, and you know, the art world and such. And they are constantly creating essentially anti-white, demoralized art that is meant to destroy our spirit, make us give up, cut us off from our past. You know, sort of like when you have like race swapping, where you'll have like a black Hamlet or something like this. These kinds of things that are just boldly spitting in our faces. And so we in the White Art Collective, we in the Patriotic Art Live and Paul's community, we're the opposite of that. We are a huge force of energy and creativity and culture. So it's we're just very grateful to you for giving us the platform to get that message out there, connect your audience to our community.
Well, I think, you know, all of this sort of reciprocal work between anybody that's concerned about our condition is absolutely vital. So, you know, you're thanking me, but I'm thanking you for doing these things, because it's easy for all of us, and it will happen to me again, after I've said this, you know, to be overwhelmed, as it were, or to get obsessed with looking at all the bad things that are happening. And, of course, to some degree, we have to pay attention to those sorts of things.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
We've got to do it. But it's not going to fix the problem. I mean, it's like, I think many of us, those of us that have gone right down the rabbit hole 500 times and just run around inside it for a long time, you know, you kind of get fixated with it, and you go, this isn't actually changing anything. It's not improving our situation. We do understand that there's a problem. We understand pretty well what that problem is. Okay, they may come up with some new tricks next week. They've got to, so they probably will, and we need to see what they are. But we have to build, you know, the way that we want to live. And I think everything you've said about the arts is absolutely true. I mean, a few weeks ago, I was banging on, I think I mentioned to you, Donald, before, that I get quite cross with architecture. That's sort of English understatement, right? I rage against it. I have to not look at it. I can't look at it. It's so dispiriting. And you know the permanency of these structures in cityscapes. Wherever they go, they're going to be sat up for years, sending out this complete sort of, you know, waves of negative energy into people, and everybody's going to go, look at that ugly building, because, you know, my parents started talking about it in the 60s, said, look at that piece of rubbish, you know, you go, when you're a kid, you don't care, you're too busy on your skateboard and chewing gum or whatever you're doing, but it's true, isn't it, you know, you have a different life when you're young, and it's great.
Well, he knows.
Yeah, go on, sorry.
I'm kidding. I said, ask Paul. He knows. He's still young. So.
Oh, yeah, he is, actually.
Really?
But you're probably very young too, Donald. I don't know how I got old. This is a big thing. Anybody that's sort of knocking, they go, they don't know how it happened. Honestly, you don't. You sat there working away, and you go, holy moly, 30 years have gone by. Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, I didn't sign up for this getting old stuff, but I'm not that old. I keep my my age a secret. It's kind of just an air of mystery about me.
Good. So if there's any keen listeners out there who want to find out Donald Kent's age, that your mission, should you accept it?
Should you accept this mission?
Why, he's 103. Good grief.
How did he do that?
No, fantastic. But yeah, no, the architecture thing is, I did technical drawing at school, which I quite liked. Never really looked at, I actually ended up working a private housing company. They just really designed boxes, but they were better than the boxes they design today. And I was involved in plotting sewage pipes. That was interesting. Yeah, soil pipes. The fall-off rate, because if they're too steep, it doesn't work. And if they're too... Anyway, it's very interesting. It's amazing how sewage tends to keep coming back into my life in all sorts of ways. Isn't it exciting, this? I didn't expect this conversation to take this sort of turn.
How did we get this? Yeah.
It's me, sorry.
It was going so well.
Yeah, it was going so well.
I sidetracked you with my silly jokes.
You didn't. No, it's great. This is exactly what it's all about. We want to be sidetracked. We're permanently being sidetracked. It's not a sort of thing. But one of the things I was banging on about a few weeks ago here, and will no doubt bang on about again, is, speaking of architecture, is this shed that they're building out in Saudi Arabia that's 175 kilometers long, or attempting to, call the Line. I'm assuming you're probably aware of it.
Yeah, I'm aware of it. Paul,
go ahead. You mentioned this. I remember having a conversation with you a couple of weeks ago about this, and I looked it up, and it's quite baffling, isn't it? It's almost like an enticing sort of desert prison.
Yeah, that's the idea of in America. I don't know how it is in Europe, but they're called smart cities, and they're essentially these wonderful new golden cages that you get, that they're trying to convince us to live in. They're making it harder and harder for people to live in the countryside, trying to force us into the cities. And it's just a slow boil. Everything, as you know, is the usual slow boil. But back to the architecture issue, it's a very major issue, to be honest. Like, I had Mark Collette on my channel a while back. I have a show called Imperium Art, and he went into some detail on the importance of architecture and talking about the history, and just when you your environment reflects back to you who you are. And this is like, for Americans, we're absolutely enchanted with Europe, and I have like this incredible romantic desire to come and live in Europe, and anyway, that's another thing. But the point is that there's so much power, in a sense, that comes off of these ancient buildings, these old buildings that have all this history and stories, narratives, and just the story you were talking about earlier with this dagger, the red dagger, being kept in a certain a pub somewhere, a fishmonger's pub or something.
I like it that you called it a pub. That's good. They would be shocked to hear you call it that.
Oh, really?
But I like the idea of it being a pub. We should all go for a pint there and have a look at that dagger. Yeah, that's great.
Meet us down at the pub after the show.
Absolutely right.
So that there it is this essentially art is the reflection of who we are. And when corporate and political interests take over, and I can't say that all of it is designed like it's Marxist or something. I mean, granted, we know about communist architecture in the Soviet Union time and how demoralizing that was. But in where we live now, at least in America for sure, it's all capitalism. It's all about just get the cheapest materials up as fast as you can, give it a pretty fake facade, and then start charging rent. So I don't know who's behind that in the UK. Like, is there a political agenda behind it, or do you feel like it's the decay of culture in some way?
It's probably, I think, a combination of the two. I think there's, definitely. I mean, the caliber of individuals that are in politics, everybody just starts laughing. Right? It's non-existent. Yeah. There's no one there. There is never any opposing voices to anything, ever. Mm-hmm. There used to be. That used to be better for them. I think they kept us more at bay that way. You would get dissenting voices, articulate ones in the Houses of Parliament, even though they might not stand a chance of winning through. They, at least these things were getting voiced out in the public. But right now, things happen to this country, and there's not a peep out of anyone. It's just a big drama in the newspapers. So that there's nothing, there's no one stands up and goes, right, we absolutely have to do something about immigration. Nobody says that at all. No one speaks forcefully and with passion and conviction about a thing. You'll get it around here in these circles. You're going to get plenty of it here, but you don't get it in public life. They're all basically, they're on the gravy train, and they've also, they're under control, you know. They're not going to be allowed to get off it. So there's no point looking to them for that. But the what you were saying there about architecture is absolutely spot. I mean, of all, it's reckoned to be one of the highest arts. It's not a competition because each, you know, the visual, the auditory, all of these different things, poetry, sculpture, which is an astonishing thing when it's done well. And I think it's astonishing because we sense that so few people do it well, which I hope is the case. I'm not, I don't want everybody to be a brilliant sculptor. Sort of. You want to go, wow, have you seen this thing? It's amazing. And I mentioned I don't know if you've ever seen it, Donald. I mean, or Paul, you might have seen it. I've mentioned it here before, and many of the listeners by now would be familiar with it. It's a documentary done by Roger Scruton about 10 or 12 years ago called Scruton on Beauty. There's a book about it. And it's about an hour long. I should get a link up somewhere for it and run it somewhere.
I'm going to look it up.
It's fabulous. And the reason I brought it up now with regards to sculpture is that there is a sculptor in there, and Scruton goes to his studio. He's a proper one. You know exactly what I mean. He's a real one. Sure. He can really do his job. He goes into his studio, and there are these towering, heroic figures of stone that he's made like 20 feet tall. And you look at these things, and you just go, wow. Yeah. I mean, literally, I just went, where is it? I want to go and hang out there and just have a cup of coffee with the guy, right? And he's so articulate as well about his assessment of modern art. I remember it this. There's much more to it than that, but paraphrasing from memory, one of the things he says, which is so true, he said, the whole of so-called modern art is words. It's basically, it runs on words. They will text, then give a title to it that contrasts with it, and you think you're looking at something profound, whereas in fact you're basically looking at a bed or some other piece of junk that's dressed up by critics and say, oh, well, it does this and it does that. No, it doesn't. It's junk, mate. And it's like we need blunt Philistines to walk in there and go, I don't think this is very good. You know, it just you can just flatten it with a comment like that, and that's crap. Because it is crap.
It's almost, it's almost part of the... well, the nature of society, what it is now in terms of, you know, lies, where we have to go along with pretending things that aren't true, you know. So this thing's heralded as the main piece, the main feature piece in an art museum, and we have to pretend that it has some form of prestige about it. So it's almost just like, you know, being conditioned to embrace this this physical lie. And just to touch on before about the on points of architecture, my wife's Romanian, and I've been quite a number of times now, and I see kind of firsthand a lot of the buildings that remain from, you know, the communist period, and they are just soulless concrete blocks. And what I find interesting also is that there are similarities in terms of design, actually. There's a lot of similarities to a lot of the housing buildings that were made in the UK, in England, sort of in the 70s. They're not far different. And I remember having a conversation with Mark Collett once, and he was telling me that you know, during the 70s there was there was the Labour Party, and they were essentially communist, had that communist mindset, and that's essentially what they were churning out. So, you know, the soulless nature of communism, and lack of the lack of appreciation for beauty, and it really does kind of put on display the general soul and spirit of that frame of mind.
Brutalism, they call it, don't they? Isn't it called brutalism? It's literally a school called, you know, and it's to brutalize you. It desensitizes you to beauty. That's the whole purpose of it.
You know? Well, I actually am an art teacher, and I was certified through New York State systems, you know, the art system here with the universities. And I have a pretty keen understanding of how it works here. And I would say that, you know, when I went back to school to become certified as an art teacher, I have to first say I quit that career because it just, that's a whole other story with dealing with that. But the art education that you get when someone goes into university here and wants to be an art teacher, you're taught that tradition is just a bunch of old white men. That, you know, the new conceptual postmodernism is all about deconstructing patriarchy, and that, you know, university students are rewarded for being overly emotional and conceptual, and you have to invent the systems and the methods and the materials to create something that's never been made before. And I think that such an approach of like, say, conceptualism, for example, could be legitimate to some extent if it weren't meant to and designed explicitly for destroying Western civilization, you know. And so the universities mm-hmm. are pumping out these teachers who then go into high schools and they you know, create more armies of young crazy kids, and they're, you know, with the addition of the LGBT agenda in schools, you can only imagine how this is a poison. It's just a amazingly effective system of poisoning our culture. And so that, you know, me being the straight white man, you know, in that environment.
I like you already, Donald. I like you already. This is great. This is what we want. We need more of that.
Right. You can imagine, right. You can imagine the challenges that I had to go through just getting through university. And then, for example, I could take over the whole show talking about stories about that, but part of the reason why I quit when I finally got into the field was because I knew that I'm going to get railroaded and this is dangerous for me. I'm both legally in danger and physically in danger because the school that I taught at had just all the worst kids from the inner city. When they got kicked out of their schools, they got sent to my school. So it was just, you know, 8-hour day of trying to stop kids from fighting. And I was like, this is not what I signed up for.
No.
And, you know, it's just a gigantic issue. So the arts is very, very much weaponized against us. It's an elitist. And when I say elite, I don't mean in the sort of, you know, the French bourgeois of, you know, Napoleon's time, but, you know, rather the small hat tribe of today that is kind of, you know, handing down the dictates on what culture.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Donald. What are you talking about?
Well, nudge,
wink, wink, say no more.
Yeah, yes. Well, code language is there.
Yeah.
But it's so, I mean, all of this, again, it's the fire and the fuel for why Paul and I do what we do. And I believe it was Paul's idea to come together and start Patriotic Live. I've got the platform, you know. Paul is Paul. He's got this great community, this great skill. It's of course connected with Patriotic Alternative, Mark Collette, and to me it's like, wow, this is awesome. What a joy to connect with him and do these really fun shows. They're very casual. I think people enjoy watching art being made live, you know, on a specific theme.
Yeah,
and
they do.
And so yeah, it there's just something about it. You get to kind of peek over our shoulders and watch us work. So like, I don't know, Paul, have we decided on what next week's theme is yet? I don't know.
No, maybe we can do that now. Maybe Paul can give us some words of sage wisdom. And
definitely not brutalism though. Definitely not.
No, please not brutalism. No, not that. No, no, we don't want that. I mean, I don't know what to say. I don't know what to say. Let's see if something comes up right now on the spur of the moment. There's nothing that sort of jumps at me, but I think when you were just saying there about people like to see people creating art, mm-hmm. I mean, one of the enchanting things about it to most people is, I know this, and nearly everybody listening probably knows this one as well, is you give someone a pencil and say, draw something, and they go, oh, I can't draw. That, you know, that one, because it's a common experience to so many people. And I wanted to actually be a cartoonist. I did when I was in my teenage years. I spent a lot of time trying to be a cartoonist, and after about 4 or 5 years of grinding away, I went, this is such hard work, it just doesn't come to me easy enough. And so maybe I'm just a bone-idle teenager at the time. Not really, but it was difficult, you know. And I'd sit and watch people who really could do it. And I went, there's a different gear in this person, and I don't have it at the moment.
Yes, that's well said.
You know, and I got a book, a very interesting book. It's about drawing, but it's actually about a lot more. It's called Drawing with the Right-Hand Side of the Brain. And I think it became quite popular, you know. And basically, it was saying, you know, the left-hand side of your brain, the bit that's full of all the logic and the facts and wants to be right all the time, that bit, the sort of dominant bit. If you ask someone to do a drawing of somebody else's face, it steps in all the time. It's going, I know what a nose looks like. I know what eyes look like. This is teeth. And of course, it keeps influencing what's coming out of the pencil end, out of the lead. And it's rubbish. You go, oh, it's nothing. And you see that look of disappointment on people's faces. They go, oh, I can't draw. And they, you know, the paper's in the wastebasket. What they were saying was, look, here's a series of exercises for you to switch that bit off. We're gonna put it to sleep. We're gonna get it bored. You've got to get it bored and almost like put it in a trance. And there were several exercises, and one of them, which was wonderful. In fact, I've still got the drawings around. It's the only time I ever felt like I could really draw. You would take a photograph, any sort of complex image at all, and turn it upside down and then copy it. And
yes, that's a great technique. Yeah.
It's fantastic. Mm-hmm. I suddenly felt different, and I got transfixed, and I went into this sort of zen-like space, me and the pencil and the paper, just looking at the shapes, not naming them or going, I know what a bridge looks like or anything like that.
Yes.
And you end up drawing this thing upside down. And of course, whilst it's upside down, you can't make head, your left hand side of your brain can't make head and a tail of it. It's just like a big sort of splurge. And I've got a drawing of Stravinsky by Picasso. Okay. Picasso really could draw. It's just that most of what he drew was absolute pants, of course. And he said later on. But in his early days, I mean, boy, that guy, he had talent.
Oh, sure.
Out.
Yeah. Sure.
It's just astonishing. Oh, yeah. You know, there's one of an altar boy that he did when he was 14. It's just amazing. It's, you go, what went wrong?
Yeah,
what went wrong, Pablo? You know, money went wrong. You know, he fell
in love. Yeah, thank you. You said it. Yeah.
He did. And he kind of said that later on, but he'd done a drawing, just a simple line drawing of Igor Stravinsky. And I copied this, I turned it around. It's like a photograph of it. I went, how on earth did that happen? So it's really a very interesting process. And all these little processes of switching that part off. And then suddenly, I mean, you know, what they're saying, I mean, anybody can draw. If you can write your name, you've got the mechanical skills to put marks on a piece of paper. Here we go. Of course, the really great illustrators. And I love magazine illustrators from the States in the 30s and the 40s, N.C. Wyeth and people like that.
Oh, my God, yeah.
And Gustave Doré. I've got loads of books by Doré, which are just ridiculous. Wonderful. You just look at them and you go, what? How did you? You know, my son sometimes picks them up. He comes up to me and goes, how did he do this? I'm going, yes, a good question. Because there's every single line of engraving on it. I'm going, I don't know. I don't know how he did it. But he did do it, you know.
He had help from angels, I think.
Well, he did. He did. No. And one of the images I've used, I was talking about the images that we use for the shows here. And one of them I used maybe on show 5. It's two cowboys. And it's done by a French-Canadian-American who's live right now, Marc Maggiore. I don't know if you know of him. They're absolutely astonishing. They're astonishing. Nice. So a critic said the clouds, you should see these clouds that he paints. They're more real than a real cloud.
Isn't that crazy?
Like hyper-realism and his command of light and shadow in these clouds. Yes. So you've got these fabulous horse. He just can draw a horse like nobody else. And there's a video of him. You were saying earlier about watching people draw. There's one of him out in the Arizona desert just doing sketches with his wife and everything. And you just go, can I hang around for a bit? I just want to be around it. Yeah. It's a kind of different, it's wonderful. Absolutely magical.
There's something to say about this on a kind of meta-cultural and meta-historical sense, that there's no other culture in the world that created the science of art that we have. If we go from the Renaissance to now, and how Westerners figured it out, and then can create these extraordinary works of art. And I mean, I'm just talking about painting, drawing and painting. I'm not even including, say, architecture or symphony orchestras and all. I mean, this is insane how advanced we are as a people, but we don't really think of it. We don't sort of notice that about ourselves. And it's something we really cannot lose touch with. I would have to say, as an artist and art teacher, maybe this could be interesting to you and people interested in art, that I would say there's generally two approaches. One I consider a fine art approach, and another a graphic art approach. So the fine art approach is essentially understanding light and shadow and making impressions of forms within that approach. And then the other being thinking of things as in terms of shapes that interlock with each other, and then textures and things. And then you can throw light on it, like drawing a mannequin, but then adding, you know, the bits and pieces, you know, that create it into, say, a person, for example. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty fascinating. I mean, people have asked me if I could teach online, and I'm like, that's a whole, I want to make.
Oh, there's a job for you. Yeah. What was that American painter that had the big TV series and everybody was painting like?
The guy with the afro. What's his name?
Yeah.
It's slipping my mind, but he's like happy clouds and pretty sky. Very relaxing.
Yeah, it's very relaxed, like Zen to watch him paint. He's just talking.
There's documentaries about this guy. He was on for.
It's amazing.
Years.
Absolutely amazing. Listen, we're at the top of the hour, so I'm going to play a song. Just wanted to add before I do, Paul. Your origins, Derby, is it you from the Midlands originally? Is that where it's from?
Midlands, Nottingham.
Okay, so I'm going to play something by a fellow Midlander. He's no longer alive. We're just going to take a quick break. It's the top of the hour. You're listening to Paul English Live, paulenglishlive.com here at WBN 324 and other assorted stations, which I'll mention after the break. I'm here this evening with PAL, the Patriotic Art Live, which is Donald Kent and Paul Patriard. Here is, I'll tell you what it is afterwards. Here we go.
Attention all listeners, are you seeking uninterrupted access to WBN 324 Talk Radio despite incoming censorship hurdles? Well, it's a breeze. Just grab and download Opera Browser, then type in WBN324.zil. And stay tuned for unfiltered discussions around the clock. That's WBN324.zil.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on the World Broadcasting Network are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of its owners, partners and other hosts or this network. Thank you for listening to WBN 324 Talk Radio.
Yeah, and thank you for being here with us tonight on this show, show number 11, Paul English Live. And I'm here with PAL, Patriotic Art Live. I quite like PAL. It's nice, is that? It's very good.
Yeah, it is.
It is. It's great. It's great.
Let's be PALs.
PALs, yes. Yes. The acronym for this show, of course, is P-E-L, so it's Pel Pal. So we're getting carried away, right? It's going to be all right, and everything like that. We're here for another hour, hopefully. Everything's going to rock and roll. If you want to call in, I've just put the phone numbers up running over the screen on Rumble. If you're on Rumble, you'll see the numbers. If you're not, I'm going to read them out to you, which is awfully thrilling, calling out telephone numbers. But we tried this last week, and it seemed to work okay. So if you're in the U.S., you dial 605-313-5866. That's 605-313-5866. And then you enter a code 566-999#. How interesting is that? If you're in the UK, you dial, well, look, I've got to wait for the number to come through, 0330-390-2135. 0330-390-2135. And yet again, you enter that same code number, 566-999#. And you'll come through and you can put some questions and send us in your charcoal sketches of things, and we'll review them here. Obviously, we can't do anything like that at all. I'm just winding you up. So welcome back to part two. Where were we before? Now, oh, that artist. Did you recognize that person, Paul? Do you have
I didn't, any idea? Actually. And I wouldn't have never placed his accent. He was obviously singing in a kind of tone to suit his influences, you know?
He was. He's bloody singers. They just sing in different ways all the time, don't they? He's no longer alive, unfortunately. He was, I think he carried a physical incident, but he's a chap called Kevin Coyne, and he's done some cracking stuff. He's a very distinctive sort of guy, not very well known, very talented bloke, and used to be a firm favourite of John Peel, which is probably way before your time, Paul. In fact, I know it is. So John Peel was the late-night radio music show here in the UK in the 70s. His show, Midnight, I think, and he had this very lugubrious Liverpool accent. Tremendous guy. And Coyne was one of his favourites. He would often sort of come back to Coyne. And he's done some great songs. There's a wonderful one called Eastbourne Ladies. And just to let you know, Donald, Eastbourne is this sleepy little seaside town here in the UK on the south coast where ladies go to retire and they do things. And it's a very comical but wonderfully acerbic sort of song. And he had a very good sort of, well, a good eye and a good ear and a good lyric sense as well. So a great character. Nice. So there you go. And he was from Derby, Paul. I think he was from Derby. So you're kind of your neck of the woods. Yeah, I think so. It's sort of Midlands, isn't it?
Derby's a beautiful place. I was living up in an old collier village when I first got married. Recently moved. But, being surrounded by so many places that were just beautiful nature. Literally a short drive, like Matlock was on our doorstep, and just so many different beautiful places. The old kind of, talking about architecture again, some of these manor houses that really epitomize a lot of our sort of culture throughout the Victorian ages. A lot of the lords and ladies that grew fantastically rich off the British Empire.
Did they?
I think so. I don't know,
yeah,
I don't know
how did. Else they afforded it. Yeah, I wasn't one of them. Were you? Have you got any in your background? No. I've got none of those.
But fortunately, in a roundabout way, I was thinking to myself, like, we would never, just general working class, blue collar people, or even a middle class type person, would never have been able to enjoy the views and the kind of just experiencing that beautiful stretch of nature and all around their buildings. in the past, and so here we are in the future, that the children, the ancestors of these people, can no longer afford to kind of upkeep them, and so they've almost rented them out and gone into partnership deals whereby the likes of National Trust would turn it into a business whereby people can come and pay and so on, and they maintain like for the place to kind of keep going, or so that they can stay there at least. But National Trust are quite woke now, so it's quite sad.
Yes, the National Trust, yes. Yeah, but some of the buildings are fantastic. You were talking earlier, Donald, weren't you, about the building situation and the rental market and the capitalism and all that kind of stuff, you know. And there's a slew of programs now. I mean, we get them over here with regards to UK and European property, and I've seen them sort of people running around with selling penthouses in New York. And these things go for astronomical amounts of money.
Yeah, it's insane. Totally insane.
It is. And the people that turn up and can afford it, they go, oh, this is really good. Yeah, we'll have this. And then there was some idiot was going to pay, oh, we'll rent this. Oh, what's the rental? $18,000 a month. You're going, wow. Hello? Yeah. Hello, what's going on?
I know. Whenever it's deranged. When I get into these kind of conversations, because I recently had a kind of an argument with someone recently who, this is the kind of person that admires people who are rich because they're rich. And I was saying that that's very foolish, you know, and that how all the money that they waste on things just to compete with other rich people. Look how much money I spent. Think about how much good that could have done for so many other people. And, you know, it's just the usual kind of thing. I think in a sense, my view is that you don't take the money with you when you go, but you do take your soul. And so if you're not a good person, then what did all that money do for you? You know, like that's really what you have to be. That's the treasure that you should be storing up, you know.
You know, those old truths, that is an old one. My dad used to say all that, and everybody used to say that. Of course, it's in one ear, out the other, isn't it? No, but Dad, I've got to get a Rolls Royce, you know, otherwise my life's meaningless and all that kind of stuff. And but it's absolutely, I mean, it's a very profound thing, actually. When you sit and think about that one, you suddenly go, why am I attached to all this stuff? And I've found the older I've got, not only can I not afford the stuff anyway, which is no great disappointment, but if you had it, you've got to clean it, don't you? You think about all that. You got to clean it, and then you got to insure it, and then you're going to worry about somebody scratching it, whatever, your boat or anything, and this, that, and the other. Oh, my helicopter needs some maintenance budgets. I mean, people buy helicopters. You're like, yeah, that's a really big blow. There's they have programs about these rich and famous people and the houses that they're buying.
Yeah.
And there was one actually down the coast from where I am, which is at a place called this house was £3.4 million. And it was in a place called Bognor Regis. It's a lovely name, isn't it? Bognor. It's got a real absence of poetry to it. And it's quite famous. It's called Regis because it's royal, because the royal family used to go there. And one of the kings on his deathbed, apparently his last words were, bugger Bognor, something, he'd had enough of it, or something like that, right, which is an apocryphal tale. So we quite like that. But this house that they had on, it was £3.4 million, and I wanted it. I don't normally want these things, but I looked at this house, I went, I want to live in that house. And it was designed, they gave you the name of the architect, it was designed about 1918. Mm-hmm. It was designed specifically for a director of Rolls-Royce, because Rolls-Royce is down there, the neck of the woods, that's where they are.
Sure.
And it was just, if we were in that house, you would be very happy. It was just fabulous. It was so beautifully done. Oak paneling everywhere, bedrooms, and it wasn't over the top. It was just, it was just right. And it was on a beachfront thing, which doesn't mean too much in the UK, because it rains all the time, you know, even on the South Coast, it rains a lot. It's just, that's the way it is. But as I just went, I could see how the quality of life and your thoughts and your imagination would be take away with you. And the owners of it were a couple who'd been there not long enough. They said he was in his mid-60s, and he'd obviously, and he was a really nice guy. These are people who'd worked for a living. He was an IT consultant, and he'd made millions doing whatever it was. Well, that was the story anyway. You know, maybe he's a drug dealer from Coventry or something. I have no idea. But he didn't come across like that. He was a great guy, and he said, well, we've only been here 12 years, he said, and we wanted to be here for the last 40, and we finally managed to get it. And now we find we've got to move, really, because it's just too damn big. There's only two of them. And the thing was huge. Yeah. So you need these properties at the right time of life. It's a bit like when you're 25, that's when you need a Ferrari. You don't need it when you're 55, when you can afford one. That's useless. But
I think you need to have like 10 kids if you're going to have a mansion like that. So you've got to fill those rooms, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you can't get them in the back of a Ferrari when you've got 10 kids. It's a useless for that sort of thing. It's terrible. You're absolutely right.
There's the World's Fair in the United States at like the beginning, turn of the century, 1800s, 1900s. In America, they had these World's Fairs in Detroit, Buffalo, at different places around the city, around the country. And they had the best architecture and the best art, and they had all these kinds of exotic displays. It was World's Fair. 1901, just for example, you're going to see the architecture is extraordinary, extraordinary. This is when electricity just started in America, and the lighting of these magical cities, which are all made of like, how do I say, just European architecture, you know, of various kinds that are kind of mashed together in these like super, this is my vision. And for the Imperium of the future, this is when we take back all our countries and we learn our lesson. Okay, we are a people as a whole, as a race, and we have to, you know, secure our borders and work together to bring back our culture and revive all this great art, architecture, etc. I'm hoping that those are the cities that they built. You know, that I think that they're just magical, and you can't
what was it called
not.
Again?
The World's Fair. So you could just Google World's Fair 1901, for example.
Fair or Sphere?
F-A-I-R, Fair.
Yeah, is that Chicago, the one you're talking about?
Chicago, I mean, there was a bunch of them around that period, but Chicago is certainly one of the
Chicago ones. Is profoundly silly when you look at it. And I mean, it's amazing. And I've seen all sorts of stories about it. I know someone who comes from Chicago. I think still a couple of these buildings are left. This taps into, we don't have to go down this path, by the way, because this is a totally separate topic. But that fair and a couple of the other ones in Europe often come up in this Tartarian line of information. I'm assuming you've stumbled across it.
I have stumbled across the Tartarian. I don't even know what to call it, culture, subculture. I don't know. You know, it's to me, I don't know yet if it fits in with like the flat earthers or if this is an actual thing that existed in the past. I enjoy those things. I don't kind of poo-poo them. I think they're fun and interesting. I've researched ufologies for 18 years. I'm interested in you know, ETs and all this kind of stuff. It's kind of more or less as a hobby. I mean, it's just an interest.
You watched Ancient Aliens, right?
Well, I'm way, way deeper than that, though. Like, whatever. There was a time when the internet was not as controlled as it is
so your
now.
Hair's even more crazy then, right?
Hey, we could do a crazy show, you know. If you want to do a crazy show, we could do. Well, we can't do it now. We've used most of this one up, but we could do a crazy show if you wanted to do one. That would be great.
I mean, it's just for fun to me. I mean, it's not a quote fun topic per se because it's very deep and profound.
Yeah.
But and then there's a lot of political dimensions to it that are very kind of terrifying. So there's a lot there, but essentially, I feel, you know, years ago. You know, my son was born. I'm holding him. I'm sitting in front of the computer. I'm like, what kind of world is he going to grow up into? All that kind of fatherly stuff. But I also thought, you know, in this box is any information that you could possibly wonder. You know, and I thought, well, I've always wondered, are UFOs real? And a few clicks later, zoom down the rabbit hole, you know. And like I said, nowadays, a lot of that information is not only controlled or hidden, but they've got agents out there that are giving false information to, like, you know, run interference and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah,
but it's fascinating stuff. Yeah.
Well, the pictures of the Chicago World's Fair are overwhelmingly wonderful. And there are many, many tales around it. I think the Tartarian thing is a story I want to be true. I have to tell you.
Yes,
I,
you're right,
the mythical, magical stories, which are an absolutely enormous part of our creative heritage. In fact, you know, the storytelling, the fairy tales, we are the people of the fairy tale. And they take place in settings which are always redolent with images of beauty and you know, all this vivid qualities that come into these stories, which impact you like a sledgehammer when you're a kid, when your mum and dad are reading them. I mean, they're just overwhelming. Stories are never as powerful as they are when you're young. I mean, they're just amazing things. You go into this different inspiring world.
Yeah. You're inspiring me because, like, Paul and I were trying to come up with a theme for next week's show, Patriotic Arts Live, and maybe something to do with fairy tales or mythologies.
Yeah.
Paul, what's your take on that?
Yeah, awesome. Celebrating our culture and traditional fairy tales would be good. Kind of a resurgence of them. What's this Tartarian?
You don't know about Tartaria, my good grief. It's 2023, Paul. Where are you?
I probably know of the visuals. Oh, yeah, you are. I'm probably not so familiar with the title, but I've probably seen a lot of the visuals.
Well, it's a wonderfully, it's a very engaging, romantic story, as I have seen it so far. I've not plowed into it with huge gusto. Don't need to. There's many, many things to do, but the basic proposition is this: that up until relatively recent times, and we're talking, I think, late 1700s, there was this vast influence across the earth with regards to architecture and buildings that originate from an ethos, a people known as Tartarians. Now, of course, we think of it as Tartary, which is out in Russia, this huge, vast empire. And some of the old maps show just how vast it was. And the idea is that with regards to buildings, the buildings generate energy because they're high. There's all sorts of stories that go with it that are really wonderfully engaging, that they were able to produce energy just from the ether by tapping into it, which is the case. You know, the wires that run through across the land on these big pylons, they're actually sucking electricity. The higher you go up, the more charge there is in the atmosphere. All of these sorts of thoughts come together. And it could be, on one level, hokum, but it also, it doesn't feel like it. And yet, I still think there are some prudent things that could be done. For example, Paul, you know, with regards to Chicago, that World Trade Fair, what I would like to see, I saw somebody telling it straight, but it was really unsatisfactory because there wasn't enough information in it. I would like to know, for example, all the architects' practices that were involved and the building firms and what their remits were and what the budgets were, because these things that go up, and they went up so quick, and then they say it's all made out of plasterwork, and you're going, but then why tear it down? Now, it could be it was for it's for financial reasons, but I suspect maybe, given what we were talking about in the first half, you start putting beautiful buildings up like that around people, and the people become ungovernable, don't they? Because they start to do their own thinking. They don't want that. They don't want you going around happy. I mean, because if you're happy, it's like if you're happy, you're not going to pay attention to them, and they must have our attention because they're basically parasites. They have to have our attention. And, you know, the fairy tales thing as well. If you're going to do the fairy tales stuff, not that I've got any documents to hand, but these are, many of them are warnings to the children. Hansel and Gretel, these are absolute warnings about real things, and they dress it up in these stories. You know what the vampires are all about, right? So these sorts of things, and that's a very, very excellent way of transmitting information down multi-generational lines is the campfire story. I need to get into it more here. They're wonderful. They're so magical, and they work. They really do work.
I think it also harkens back to a time when people told stories, you know, and maybe there was less access to books and literature and things. And this is going way back, too, right?
That's right, yeah. Do you want to take a call? We've got someone in the room who's just joined. Sure. Well, he's been there patiently waiting. Paddy McGee, I'm going to add him to the call. We've also got Pale. Pale, if you want to come into the call, just type in the chat and I'll see it. I know you like to come in and just listen and stuff, but let me just add Paddy for now. Here we go.
Hi there.
Hi, hello. Paddy. Hello, good evening. Welcome to the show. How are you this fine evening?
Yeah, not bad, thanks. Just a little thing. It's apropos when you were something you said earlier about our people being kind of more advanced when it comes to sort of art and science of art. It reminded me of an article I was linked to in The Guardian recently, just a briefing. It's like it's a letter that's written into their, one of their Q&A sections. I can post the link in the private chat there. And I just thought I'd read it because it's quite a short thing. It's titled, My Community Orchestra is All White. How can I make it more multicultural?
Oh, God. Yeah.
Dear misunderstanding, I'm the chair of a large community orchestra. We don't audition, and we are a very welcoming family from all walks of life. Our set list range is huge. Hendrix, Bowie, Björk, Radiohead. We've played in music festivals and have loads of members in loads of bands all over the city, but there's no denying we're all white. How can we reassure the audiences who come and see us and obviously enjoy what we do that they would be so welcome among us as musicians? Our age ranges from early 30s to 80. I'd say most of our members are 35 to 40, many with young families, so we're not stuffy. We've tried various outreach things with the Somali and Kurdish residents of our city, but I worry that not enough young people have the opportunity to learn music full stop. There are adults out there who are luckier, yet it seems very difficult to invite them to come even for a taster. It might be perceived as intimidating, I'm sure. I was very nervous when I joined, to be honest, with hurdles of my own to leap, but I know these bear little comparison. Our city is a magnificent multicultural place, and if anywhere could do it, it would be us. Any thoughts? Our history is complex, but our love of music is fundamental. It's an excellent glue in a fracturing world. And I just thought that kind of gave a really good insight into the mind of the sort of liberal orchestra member.
May I speak to that? So there's no reason whatsoever for us to try to be diverse or multicultural. Rather, the other direction. It's our duty to keep our traditions and build on those traditions. Other people can come and enjoy that, people from all cultures of the world, but the concept of making an orchestra more diverse is absurd. It doesn't have anything other than the point to deconstruct your culture. And that is, no other country, China is not saying, how can we get more Africans to play Chinese music, traditional theater or something of this nature? It's literally absurd. So I think that we have to stop apologizing for that. We have to stop being kind of like nice about it. We have to be strong and bold and clear that these are our traditions and everyone is welcome to love and enjoy them. But we're not changing who we are for any reason. So that I have a really strong perspective on that. I think that you will find it amazing how people, specifically from East Asia, master Western arts. I was just watching something on YouTube with a Chinese woman playing violin and being like, wow, she's a virtuoso. And you know, China has a highly advanced culture, say, as opposed to, I don't know, Saudi Arabia or something in different regards. And I'm not belittling them. They have their own music and culture and something, and that's beautiful in its own way. But if someone chooses to carry that into their life, make it their goal to learn that art form, then God bless them. That's beautiful, and that can happen. I lived in Asia for 5 years. I studied Chinese landscape painting, Kung Fu, Qigong, all this stuff. And it's because I loved it, and it enriched my life. And then at a certain point, I was like, you know what, I'm gonna let that go, and I'm going to start focusing on Western art and culture and what are my traditions and getting, and you know, it gave me a nice contrast to see the difference between those things, more so than someone who has not gone out of their cultural tradition. But at the same time, what I'm saying is simply, you know, respect your own space and protect your own space, which is, your tradition, your cultures. That's, Paul, what are your thoughts on that? My pal, Paul.
Yeah, similar, really. I mean, I believe that the culture comes from the blood of the people, generally speaking. You know, these people are interested in sort of orchestra and, you know, our music when we're not influenced by outsiders tends to gravitate towards more kind of string-based instruments and things. And you know, we are quite diverse in our musical talents, but I think different groups tend to create have different expressions of creativity in general. Mm-hmm. So you know, for example, Black people would tend to gravitate to a totally different type of sound. So creativity is something that comes from within. It's an inner expression that is outward. So what I'm reading here is it's essentially just it's just fake. It's trying to bend things that don't necessarily need to go or should go. It's just there to tick boxes and and essentially tear down creativity, or at least the natural culture of these people, and trying to inject something that just doesn't belong.
Yeah, I thought it was a really good illustration of the way like liberals' minds work, because it never really occurs to them that maybe it's just like that there's no problem with your orchestra being white, and that's kind of like the natural way for it to be. It's like we've got to inject our dogma into this.
Paddy, did you just say how liberals' minds work? I'm having a problem.
So to speak. Yeah.
So here's a funny thought. How come there's no, say, like black organization that says, how can we find more white people to join rap bands and hip hop bands? How can we do that? Because we need more diversity in the black community. Nobody cares about that other than white liberals. And it really is truly rooted in a hatred. To want to reap people. This making feel comfortable, safe in a culture. This is sociopathic to think that we have to have quotas, like racial quotas. That's really just a form of Marxism. So we have to abandon that.
It's the saddest tale. Paddy, well done for finding that one. I mean, that's just unbelievably bad. People are mad, really. You kind of think, how much thought should we give that? These people are so far gone with this. We must accommodate the other at all costs. It's more important than anything. It's actually not important at all. I mean, it's just absolutely completely irrelevant.
Exactly.
Incredibly foolish and stupid, And I can't... Very, very odd what's happened to people. The onslaught has been slow and gradual and relentless for decades, really. And, it's really kicked into full gear over the last 20 or 30 years more than any other period. It's come that way. So why anybody would want to do that? What is up with them? It's just absolutely bizarre. As Paul, you were saying, people gravitate towards a different sound. I've got an idea about race, or a good comparison, or an analogy that I tend to think of whenever I'm trying to talk to people about it, because most white people bridle very quickly when you bring the topic up. It's difficult for them to hear it. Oh, you can't talk like that. The racist police are going to be knocking at our door any minute now. Yeah, probably are, really. But I liken races to like different types of music at different frequencies. Each one in and of its own self is natural to everybody else in that race. But if you put them together, it's a bit like putting a classical orchestra and a reggae band in the same rehearsal room and go, right, lads, all play now. And they go, how's that sound? That doesn't sound good. Is anybody happy here? No one's happy. Right, okay. So what's the problem? It's because you're not allowing, they say, it's because you're not allowing the other people to play. No, it's got nothing to do with it. It's a real estate problem. Location, location, location. You're in the wrong place, right? Yeah. It's not that. Yeah. It's not that we like or dislike or want or don't want your stuff. This cannot work because of nature, because of frequencies, because we are different. And isn't that the diversity, dear Mr. Liberal Mind, that you say you want? We've already had it. We've got it naturally in the earth. Stop doing this artificial version and lying about it,
What this is called is race realism. And it's the term that we need to use to replace being called racist. So when someone says, you're racist or that's a racist, blah, blah, blah. You simply say, well, I'm a race realist. I'm founded in science, data, statistics. I acknowledge the presence of other cultures, their et cetera, all of that. Because ultimately, if they can say that whites don't exist, then that means nobody exists, that there's no other cultures either. It's a construct. No, it's not. It's a Marxist dialectic that's meant to destroy us. But we can create our own dialectic, and race realism is a very strong one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that letter, Paddy, that you were reading out, I'm a wonder, why didn't they say we need more Eskimos in the band? It's ridiculous. And what about dwarves? I mean, it's dwarfist as well. In fact, this is the thing. People go, oh, no, we've got to include everybody. Well, that's a lie. You can't. What are you talking about? It's complete nonsense. Is that people stop, don't they, at the very first sort of line of resistance? They go, oh yeah, I must be nice to everybody. What, you're going to have everybody in the band? How about incompetence? I mean, just because you're incompetent on the guitar doesn't mean you couldn't be in a band. Let's get you in as well. Anybody want to come and watch this stuff? No, I'm going down the pub, mate. Right. Oh, I can't. It's closed, you know, because it's racist or something like that. It's nonstop. People are sort of shooting themselves in the foot. Yeah, yeah. Very, very silly. But if you could find architects, just going back to that one as well, sorry, we can bomb back to this, but architects that did the Chicago thing, I'd love to know about that. I really would. Mm. Somebody wrote, by the way, on Rumble, just want to read this out. This is a comment from, if I can find it, yeah, Cat7. Hi, Cat7. She said, flat earth level bogus. I tend to go with that. Mud flood and Tartaria, waste of time. Yeah, I know what you mean, but I find it intriguing. It's actually opened my mind up to a lot of things, really, the Tartarian thing. And it's exotic, and it's got me. I admit it. It's a bit like saying, you know, do you believe in giants? I go, yeah, I want to. And do you think that the Earth's hollow? I don't know, but I want it to be. That's what I'd really like it to be like that. And I'd like there to be giants under bridges and things. I want all that stuff back, for real, you know. But she goes on to, or he goes on to say, people cannot accept white people could build such amazing things centuries ago. It's a very good point. I think we can. I think we can accept that. Oh, and there's a building actually in, or there's a centre in London about the building of St. Paul's Cathedral, which is one of these astonishing buildings that are built. And I need to know more about that. They don't do enough documentaries about how these guys with wooden scaffolding and whatever they had spent 80 years putting this stuff up, because it's amazing. It's amazing. You look at it and you go, oh, yeah. And people say, well, we can't do that today. That's not true. We can. We could do better than that. It's just that the entire culture is driven to make you build crap. I don't want to build crap, you know. And like you were saying earlier, Donald, that, oh, it's all about cost effectiveness. There's no cost effectiveness in it. These buildings go up for 30 years. They fall down. They're torn down. They're rubbish. Right. Everybody, why don't you put one that lasts for 500?
That's cost effective. That's the nature of nationalism, is people before politics, people before, you know, dollars and all of that kind of thing, that all of our resources should serve us. And this is the third position. This is the, you know, it's not communism, it's not capitalism, it's the third position. Mm-hmm. And it's truly, you know, putting people first in a nationalist sense. And nationalism is the people, the land and the people are one. So I think Paul can speak a lot on that as well. But, there's just a lot of directions we can go with that.
Yeah, I mean, we are capable of building that today, but unfortunately, we don't have the same vision, a unifying vision or means to do that. Before, a lot of that was done under the Catholic Church, and although there are some, some bad that came from Catholic Church, I think, in terms of a lot of the oppression towards the poor and that, but they did spearhead, and it was all done in the name of Christ, and there were these massive iconic tributes dedicated to God in them, and everyone came together to build this this vision. And I think until we align our own kind of creativity and interest for a common cause, I think then we'll start to see buildings like that again. But until then, obviously money takes precedence.
Yeah, it does.
I guess, to my understanding, the way churches were made is over generations, and that the community all came together and worked on it. So, I mean, it's insane to think of, like, you know, how these great churches were created in the time they were created, with whatever resources and technology they had, compared to the amazing technology we have today. You know, I always say things like, you know, we can put a robot on Mars, but we can't solve homelessness, or, you know, or we have to have XYZ, you know, fill in the blank. We have the resources, we have the science, etc. It's, again, about putting people first, and that's what nationalism is.
Yeah. It has to be about that. Everything has to be focused on the well-being of the individual. I mean, one of the little themes I bang on about here of course, yeah. A subtext that everybody has accepted that they tend to not think about consciously is that they work for the economy. The economy, the economy, the economy. Oh, the economy, says whoever is the economy. Right. Yeah, oh, yeah, the economy. I better start worrying about that. You better. The government want you to worry about it. Come on, let's crack on with the worrying about it. No one says the people, the people, the people. And no one says, actually, to hell with this economy, Lark. It's, it was all solved a long time ago, which it was, by the way, because they just don't want it solved. And we need the economy to work for the people. That simple idea needs to be, and you know, we're facing the communications challenge, which is not a lack of constructive ideas. There's absolute rivers of those. And we don't even need new ones. We simply need, in great part, to return and restore the thinking that got us where we were 100 years ago before it all went pear-shaped in the last century. But that's really what we're looking at, is to transmit this. So we need more transmission power. We need bigger media platforms. We need to be, you know, tap dancing our way to a better world, or whatever we need to do to get attention for these areas and to make it fun and enjoyable and informative. And I guess we are doing that, you know, and the idea is to keep doing more of it and do it better.
I think that's what the PAL show's about in part, you know. I think... you know, when Paul and I connected, we both, you know, of course, like, you know, Jeff Winston passed away, and then that sent a huge ripple out into the white art community, if you will, on both sides of the pond. And we all had a moment to sort of reconnect and come together around this sad event. And then I kept kind of bringing up the question. Many people were asking, well, what's next? You know, what's going to happen to the White Art Collective? And I started off saying, well, you know, that was Jeff's business. It was a multimedia business that he owned. However, the word White Art Collective really refers to the community that came as a result of it. And this is since around 2017. So it's been a long time in development and has grown and grown. So, you know, I essentially have said to the core members and then to the main audience that, you know, it's on us to carry that torch and keep going. So somehow Paul and I connected, and I think he came to me. I don't remember exactly how that all fell into place. Yeah. But I love what he's doing.
Right.
And I think it just made sense, you know, the idea that in a sense he's kind of the White Art Collective of the UK, you know. So like, okay, we need to carry on. Let's connect. Let's do this thing. And we've only done a couple shows, but this is going to be a regular thing.
I mean, if people want to catch your show, Donald and Paul, where do they go to catch it? I can put the information up afterwards, but right now, where would they go if someone wants to watch? When does it occur? What's your schedule and all that kind of stuff?
Paul, do you want to take it from there?
Well, it's on Tuesdays, and I believe the time is, there was a discrepancy on that. I thought it was 4 p.m. GMT, but I think it's a little later, isn't it?
No, so we have to come up with a time. I think, I don't know, are you still in Romania or are you in Eastern Europe?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you know, when you come back, we can switch the time around, but it's been 12 o'clock noon on Tuesday in the East Coast. Either way, people can catch the playback anytime. But if they go to my channel, Kent-Art on YouTube, I did actually send you the link in Telegram earlier, so if you can grab that and put it out there.
I will. I'll put it in the description of this show once it's finally done. I'm going to have to. But that's fine.
Yeah,
that's great.
Patriotic Art Live is on the playlist. There's several shows on the playlist, but that's our specific one. And so, of course, if you YouTube, you just hit the bell and subscribe and you'll get a notification as to when the shows are coming. And I think, we'll work that out. You know, Paul and I will work out like times and stuff, but the show's running roughly an hour and a half, I would say. I mean, when you're doing art, I don't think we've ever finished a single piece on a show yet, because, you know, trying to squeeze a work of art into an hour is not the easiest thing.
No. Couldn't really run it on the radio then, could we? You'd have to be telling people to imagine.
Right.
Yeah. Now imagine this. I've just dropped, this is brilliant. Yeah, fantastic. It's going to
be a bit difficult. Well, We'll hire you for that job. How does that sound?
Well, I'll do the voiceover for you. Well,
he's picked up his pencil now.
He's looking pensive. He's staring off into the mid distance. He's off. There it is. Oh, it's a face. No, it's another doodle.
Oh, sorry. He's botched a line.
Yeah. Look at that. He's throwing the pencil across the room. Oh, my God.
It's like the old football games you'd hear on the radio. And you're like, he's going down the center and he scores, that kind of thing.
They're better. It's actually more dramatic on the radio because the listeners imagining the most fantastic stuff, and then when they see it for real life, they go, But not when it comes to the art, of course. You have to see it. Yeah, I'm being a little bit silly, of course. You can't really do that.
We've wanted to have guests on, and we want to also take requests from the audience. The show's new, so we're just kind of focusing on a theme. Last show was based on the speechmaker from Finland, Kai Moros. I don't know if you or your audience are familiar with Kai Moros.
Yeah, well, I'm familiar. Kai Moros, M-U-R-R-O-S, Kai. He's a Finnish intellectual nationalist, isn't he? And he makes some very salient and telling points regularly.
Yes. Exactly. He's also a personal friend. So he has a new speech out, and he sent me that. And unfortunately, I had some technical difficulties on the show. Most of the speech came out and was very inspiring, very intense information. And the way that he presents it, he's just so good. But I'm going to actually do a separate show that's just exclusively on that and maybe try to pull together a panel discussion on it. That would be good.
Mm. But I'll have to try and tap you up and get a connection with Kai, because I won't mind having him on here at some point later.
He's very shy.
Is he really? Well, there's no visuals. He's not have to go on video. This is all he can lurk in the gloom with this. This is the whole idea.
His art is his speech making, and once he's got all that kind of laid out in front of him, he delivers it really powerfully. Anyway, I can try.
You don't have to. I've just trapped you live on air, begging you for things like this. But
what do I do?
You don't do anything. You just go, "Oh, Paul, be quiet." Just sort me. No. It'll be all right.
No. I mean, this is the thing. Kai is very excited that I'm kind of revitalizing his work, and then I'm not saying that I'm inspiring Kai to write more speeches. I wouldn't ever do that. But here's a guy with amazing skill and insight, and he's a big inspiration to our movement. Mm-hmm. So I'm kind of hoping that if I can facilitate, put a little fire under there and say, hey, I'll give you the platform, you do your work, and I'll spread it over here. So hopefully more can happen. So I think connecting you with him would be a good thing as well.
Yeah, I've got one of his speeches, a couple of minutes long somewhere. Hate is good. All about hate.
It's a powerful speech.
There's
it's
a lot amazing. Of talk about hate in that lovely sort of Finnish accent, the way he says
yeah,
English.
I know.
There's a lot of talk about hate these days.
Yes.
And, I've thought about that. People that hate, what do you call them? Oh, you're a real hater. You hate the haters, And, of course, it's just a word that needs to be examined and, you do a bit of exposition on it. And, of course, all of the charge disappears because hating is a part of life. But people are scared of it. No, we're all going to love one another. Well, we're not, actually. Not all the time. It's not going to happen.
You point
to me that period in history where that happened all the time, and I'll have a look. But I got one? No, nothing. It's life. Life has got conflicts in it and things, and people get upset, naturally, and for good reason, often.
There's got to be a biological reason why people hate, and it's mostly to protect yourself. And we, in the West, need to protect ourselves right now.
It's the same with fear, isn't it? I mean, it's an emotion that you can say it's a negative emotion, but it's a negative emotion which is designed to bring about good things in many ways. To have fear of something can save your life. It can keep you from falling into dark paths. And so hate is probably that thing which builds a charge in us to have the kind of the willpower to change the current state that you're not content with.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. I always say that our movement is a human rights movement. Our enemies are brilliant at harnessing hate. It's all hate. They hate themselves, those who are white. They hate non-whites hate us for being white and for being everything that we are. And to collectivize that hatred, it's a profoundly powerful force. And look at what they've done. Look at how much they've accomplished with that. And, you know, they're openly telling us that they hate us and they want us to go away and blah, 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 all this stuff. So, and meanwhile, we're being polite with that. Like, you know, I mean, it's not that I'm saying, you know, rah, rah, hate or something, but I think you could, we should have a discussion about how do we work with this? What does it mean? What can we do? Because suppressing hatred of people who are rob, raping, and killing us seems like a kind of sociopathy on a mass scale.
Well, my dictionary, I've got a dictionary here. I've got a few, actually. I use a Chambers. It sounds like a chamber pot, doesn't it? But it's a cracking dictionary. It's a big one, and I like it a lot. And the definition of hate in there, because I've memorized this, I mean, there's a bit more to it, but it's very simple. It's a strong aversion to or dislike of. A strong aversion to or dislike of. Now, so therefore, I'm not aware of anyone who's alive who hasn't got that going on. In fact, if you haven't got that going on at times, you're probably not alive. You sort of break it down, then you're saying, well, what's that all about? Well, it means possibly, one way of looking at it is, you have an internal value system that's important to you, that's learned, that's improving with time, and suddenly you find yourself in a situation or in the presence of someone or something, like a thing for me that I hate is beetroot. Mm-hmm. I'm being flippant, but it's true. I don't like beetroot. I don't like the smell of it. I have a strong aversion and dislike of it. Of course, so if I say I hate beetroot, people know exactly what I mean. But if you go, oh, I hate that person, then, well, now it's getting a bit awkward because there might be some kickback. And so it's all that sort of thing. But that's what happens in relations. Things get watered down. You build something, say, in a small group. Someone turns up. It goes slightly pear-shaped. It's not the same intensity. 3 months go by. It's a shadow of its former self. You hate it. You go, I don't want this anymore. This is no good to me. You know, it happens all the time, doesn't it, with all sorts of things.
What we're living in is a kind of dialectical paradigm where non-whites or anti-whites can hate freely, and laws and policies are created to stop us from protecting ourselves from them. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't post something online to express hatred that, you know, there were rape gangs in X town in the UK or something, you know, because now you're inciting something. But you're expressing a normal human emotion under an extreme situation that makes total sense. If you know, the people from other countries that are living in our countries did the same thing, they would get a free pass. Mm-hmm. So we have to recognize, like, step back a little bit and see. I think our tendency as a people is to maybe over-intellectualize and moralize these things among ourselves. That's fine because we are an in-group. We are the same people. But when other people who are not us come into our world and are weaponized with this kind of Marxist dialectic, then they're shooting fish in a barrel. Like, we're just victims. We're easy targets. Mm-hmm. And our own, you know, politicians and police, et cetera, are enforcing this kind of Marxism against us. So we have to figure out how to get around that. And, you know, I know that America and the UK are very different places in terms of, you know, we have guns and free speech and these kinds of things, But I'm desperately passionate about trying to help Europe in this regard, because I know it's far worse, and I know America's headed that way. So, like, this is an important discussion that we all need to have, but we have to also be very honest about it and look at ourselves and saying, like, let's be very cautious not to get caught up in the dialectics that are used against us. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And we can also use them, I know now within our circles, we're starting to use our own phrases and dialectics and weaponizing language against them. And I mean, we live in an age where we don't address the root problems. We are constantly brushing over and addressing the symptoms only. And so we never tackle the root of the problem. And there's a reason that is, because it's ideologically driven, and that ideology is still got work to do, I guess. And so the not corporations and organizations that are kind of part of this spider's web essentially just try to suppress, don't they? So
they do. I mean, as a big context as well, a big thing that causes most people to drift in this way is that they've bought into this idea, because it's the only idea really that's running around in the mainstream media for the last 40 years, that we're all going to come together in one great community and it's going to be great. You see, that's how you solve these problems in the world. We're all going to live with one another and we're all going to tolerate one another and it's all going to just work out great. And, you know, yet again, that's the thing I say, all right, fantastic. You got any examples of that in history? Come on, because surely it must have been tried before.
Yeah.
You know, you know, over the last 2, 3, 4,000 years, we've got quite a bit. Well, got one example? One? One.
It sells hamburgers or something, you know. It makes it look like, oh, I want to be part of this fantasy utopia, you know. And by the way, buy these shoes or something.
Yeah, but it's a very dangerous idea because it seduces people at a very, oh, that sounds great. Yeah, okay. I mean, who could possibly be against that? Are you against that? What, are you evil? Are you a hater? Actually, I'm a realist, really. Well, I've just thought about it more than just at the first level of thinking. How about that? Do you want to give
there
it a go?
Race realism. There you go. Mm-hmm. So later this evening, actually, I have a show on my channel on YouTube. The show's called Equal Training. I mentioned it earlier.
Yeah.
And we're tackling the topic of white privilege. And so this is, again, a dialectic. It's a concept that was designed to weaponize anti-whites against us. And one of the interesting concepts about so-called white privilege is that when you challenge it, people using it who are, you know, of course funded by, you know, nefarious organizations that are out to, you know, destroy Western civilization, that they can change the dial on it. They can change it from class to gender to race, and they kind of evade the topic of what is. So, you know, you would never go to China, and I just use China as an example, any country, Japan, whatever, and say, oh, you know, all the signs are in Japanese and I can't read them. That's Japanese privilege. You know, like it's this ludicrous. So the thing is that the people who are using this language against us, they have positions of power. They use the, in a sense, it's all about the legal framework. So law and language go hand in hand. You know, how you use the law is how you interpret the words. So when people invent words and then assign meanings to these words and phrases, then now you're in a whole new ball game. And so we have to do that on our own. We have to break it down, create our own language, show that, you know, these people are not genuine in coming at us with these concepts and demonstrate like the negative impacts of it and how irrational it is. Break them to pieces, deconstruct them.
Yeah, Donald, I want to welcome Brian. Brian, I hope you've not been hanging around there a bit, but let me just add Brian to the stage. Brian's here. Here we go.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you, Brian. Hi, welcome to the show.
Well, it's interesting listening to you guys. I could talk about so much. I live in Kansas City, and I put the post that Tartania was in our textbooks in the United States, the history textbooks in the 1850s. And they even had the flag in the textbook in color. And what they do, they're doing it now here, is when you read these stories, how they're tearing down all the statues of Robert E. Lee and Thomas Jefferson, in 100 years, no one will even know what the United States of America was. They won't know it's existing.
There'll
be shows like you guys have, and they'll be saying, what about this United States, you know?
Right.
Well, and someone will say, well, I don't believe it even existed. I think it's all just
it's a myth.
Yeah, it's a myth. Conspiracy. So that's how they work. And so there, it's part of why they had the fire, the San Francisco fire in 1906. There was a lot of Tartanian architecture there. And so they had to cover it up. Or if you look at photographs of downtown Tokyo in 1915 with the old Model A, you know, cars, whatever, there's Tartanian architecture. It doesn't fit in with the Orient. And you can find those pictures online. So, and as far as you guys talking about why they're doing all this stuff with white privilege and all the other stuff. Okay, I do something called Chakra Dhyana twice a day.
We got two minutes, Brian, if that, a minute and a half, just to let you know.
Well, then I won't go into it. But anyway, it's from the divine that you're racial prejudice, because what you're doing is you're protecting your DNA. When you have blacks and whites mating, then your DNA gets screwed up and you can't have a soul that's a higher level soul incarnating. So it's intentional. They're trying to ruin your DNA. And I could go into detail on it, but we don't have time.
Come back next week, Brian, and come in. You're right with the DNA. It produces aberrated vessels. The vessels are messed up. Of course, we're not allowed to talk about this stuff, but we have to talk about it because it's key. So your points are well received. And the thing you mentioned about Tartaria, very interesting about those books. Maybe we should do a show on it, and people that hate it, they won't want to listen, but it's intriguing. It's really intriguing. Thanks for calling in. Here we are. We're at the last minute and we're wrapping up. So I want to thank my guests tonight, Paul Patriot and Donald Kent from PAL, the Patriotic Art Live. And look up their stuff on YouTube. I'll put the link in, as I said, afterwards. Thanks for everybody that called in. Thanks, Paddy. Thanks, Pale. I know you didn't come in. And thank you, Brian, for turning up here at right at the tail end. Come in a bit early, maybe next week, if you like. We'll be back here same time next week. Till then, have a fantastic time. See you at 8 o'clock next week, 3 p.m. Eastern. And go well. Keep good. Bye for now.
Take care.